jumble of bright red curls. Her skin was white as cream with just the barest hint of freckle. Her lips a pale, dangerous pink. Her eyes a bright, dangerous green. "Thank you," I said, somewhat belatedly.
"You're welcome, love."
She smiled playfully with her eyes and brushed her hair back from her bare shoulder.
"It looked like you were almost asleep in your seat."
"I nearly was. A long day and a long road."
"That's a shame indeed," she said with playful regret as she rubbed the back of her neck. "If I thought you'd still be on your feet in an hour, I'd take you off them."
She reached out and twined her fingers lightly through the hair on the back of my head.
"The two of us would be enough to start a fire."
I froze like a startled deer. I cannot say why, except perhaps that I was tired from several days on the road. Perhaps it was that I'd never been approached in such a forthright manner before. Perhaps I was young and woefully inexperienced. Let us leave it at that. I scrambled desperately for something to say, but by the time I found my tongue, she'd taken a half step away and given me a shrewd look. I felt my face grow hot, embarrassing me further. Without thinking, I looked down at the table and the dinner she'd brought. "Potato soup," I thought numbly. She gave a small, quiet laugh and touched my shoulder kindly.
"I'm sorry, lad. You look like you were a little more..."
She broke off, as if reconsidering her words, then started again.
"I like the fresh look of you, but I didn't think you were that young."
Though she spoke gently, I could hear the smile in her voice. It made my face burn even hotter, all the way to my ears. Finally, seeming to realize that anything she said would just embarrass me further, she took her hand off my shoulder.
"I'll be back to see if you need anything later."
I nodded dumbly and watched her go. Her retreat was pleasing, but I was distracted by the sounds of scattered laughter. I looked around to see amusement on the faces of the men sitting at the long tables around me. One group raised their mugs in a silent, mocking salute. Another fellow leaned over to pat my back consolingly, saying,
"Don't take it personal, boy. She's turned all of us away."
Feeling as if everyone in the room was watching me, I kept my eyes low and began to eat my dinner. As I tore off pieces of bread and dipped them in my soup, I composed a mental catalog of the extent of my idiocy. Surreptitiously, I watched the red-haired serving girl entertain and rebuff the ploys of a dozen men as she carried drinks from table to table. I had regained a bit of my composure by the time Martin slid into a chair next to me.
"You did a good job with Daydan out there," he said without preamble.
My spirits lifted a bit.
"Did I?"
Martin nodded slightly as his sharp eyes wandered over the crowd that filled the room.
"Most folk try to bully him, make him feel stupid. He'd have paid you back 10 times the trouble if you'd done it that way."
"He was being stupid," I pointed out. "And when you come right down to it, I did bully him." It was his turn to shrug.
"But you did it smart, so he'll still listen to you."
He took a drink and paused, changing the subject.
"Hesper offered to share a room with him tonight," he said casually.
"Really?" I said, more than slightly surprised. "She's getting bolder." He gave a slow nod.
"And?"
I prompted.
"And nothing. Daydan said he'd be damned before he spent money on a room he should have for free."
He slid his eyes to me and raised an eyebrow.
"You're not serious," I said flatly.
"He has to know. He's just playing the simpleton because he doesn't like her."
"I don't think so," Martin said, turning toward me and lowering his voice a bit. 3 span ago, we finished a caravan job from Raelian. It was a long haul, and Daydan and me had a pocket full of coin and nothing in particular to do with it. So by the end of the night, we're sitting in this grubby little dockside tavern, too drunk to stand up and leave, and he starts talking about her.
Martin shook his head slowly.
He went on for an hour, and you wouldn't have recognized the woman he was describing as our hard-eyed Hespa. He practically sang about her.
He sighed.
He thinks she's too good for him, and he's convinced if he so much as looked at her sideways, he'd end up with his arm broken in three places.
Why didn't you tell him?
Tell him what? That was before she started going all cow-eyed over him. I thought his worries were fairly sensible at the time. What do you think Hespa would do to you if you were to give her a friendly pat on any of her friendlier parts?
I looked over to where Hespa stood at the bar, one foot tapped roughly in time to the rhythm of the fiddle. Other than that, the set of her shoulders, her eyes, the line of her jaw were all hard, almost belligerent. There was a small but noticeable gap between her and the men standing on either side of her at the bar.
I probably wouldn't risk my arm either, I admitted.
But he has to know by now. He isn't blind.
He's no worse off than the rest of us.
I started to protest, then glanced at the red-haired serving girl.
We could tell him, I said.
You could. He trusts you.
Martin sucked at his teeth with his tongue.
Nah, he said, setting his drink down firmly. It would just make things muddier. Either he'll see it, or he won't. In his own time, in his own way.
He shrugged.
Or not, and the sun will still rise in the morning.
Neither of us spoke for a long while. Martin watched the buzzing room over the top of his mug, his eyes growing distant. I let the noise of the place fade to a low, comforting purr as I leaned against the wall, drowsing. And as my thoughts untended tend to do, they wandered to Denna. I thought about the smell of her, the arch of her neck near her ear, the way her hands moved when she talked. I wondered where she was tonight, if she was well. I wondered just a bit if her thoughts ever wandered into warm musings of me.
"Hunting bandits shouldn't be hard. Besides, it'll be nice to get the jump on them for a change, lawless damn rabble bastards."
The words drew me out of my warm drowse like a fish yanked from a pool. The fiddler had stopped playing to have a drink, and in the relative quiet of the room, Daydan's voice was loud as a donkey's bray. I opened my eyes and saw Martin was looking around in mild alarm too, no doubt roused by the same words that had caught my ear. It only took me a second to spot Daydan. He was sitting two tables away having a drunken conversation with a gray-haired farmer. Martin was already getting to his feet. Not wanting to draw attention to the situation, I hissed, "Get him!" and forced myself back into my seat. I gritted my teeth as Martin threaded quickly through the tables, tapped Daydan on the shoulder, and jerked a thumb toward the table where I sat. Daydan grumbled something I'm glad I didn't hear, and grudgingly pushed himself to his feet. I forced my eyes to wander around the room rather than follow Daydan. Tempe was easy to spot in his mercenary reds. He was facing the hearth, watching the fiddler tune his instrument. There were several empty glasses on the table in front of him, and he had loosened the leather straps of his shirt. He eyed the fiddler with a strange intensity. As I watched, a serving girl brought him another drink. He looked her over, his pale eyes moving pointedly up and down her body. She said something, and he kissed the back of her hand as smoothly as a courtier. She blushed and pushed at his shoulder playfully. One of his hands moved smoothly to the curve of her waist and rested there. She didn't seem to mind. Daydan stepped close to my table, eclipsing my view of Tempe just as the fiddler lifted his bow and began to saw out a jig. A dozen people came to their feet, eager to dance.
"What?"
Daydan demanded as he came to stand in front of my table.
"Have ye called me over here to tell me it's getting late? That I've got a busy day tomorrow and I should tuck my little self into bed?"
He leaned forward onto the table, putting his eyes more on level with mine. I caught a sour smell on his breath. Dreg. A cheap, repulsive liquor that you can start fires with. I laughed dismissively.
"Hell,
I'm not your mum. Actually, I had been about to say that very thing and scrambled mentally for something else to distract him with. My eye lighted on the redhead that had served me my dinner earlier that evening, and I leaned forward in my seat. I was wondering if you could tell me something, I said in my best conspiratorial tone. His scowl gave way to curiosity, and I lowered my voice a little more. You've been here before, right? He nodded, leaning a little closer. Do you know what that girl's name is? I nodded my head in the redhead's direction. Daydan took an overcareful look over his shoulder that surely would have drawn her attention if she hadn't been facing away from us.
The blonde one the Adam's pawing at? Daydan asked.
Redhead. Daydan's broad forehead wrinkled as he squinted the far side of the room into focus.
Lucene?
He asked softly. He turned to me, still squinting.
Little Lucy?
I shrugged and began to regret my choice of diversionary tactic. An explosive laugh burst out of the big man and he half fell, half slid onto the bench across from me.
Lucy!
He chuckled a little more loudly than I liked.
Quoth, I had you all wrong!
He slapped the table with the flat of his hand and laughed again, nearly tipping himself over backward on the bench.
Ah, you've got a good eye, boy, but you haven't got a damn chance.
My battered pride pricked up at this. Why not? Isn't she, well... I trailed off, making an inarticulate gesture. He somehow managed to gather my meaning.
Aho?
He asked incredulously.
God, boy, no! There's a couple around.
He made a sweeping gesture over his head, then lowered his voice to a more private level.
Not really whores, mind you. Just girls who don't mind a little extra at night.
He paused, blinked.
Money. Extra money. And extra other things,
he chortled. I just thought... I began weakly.
Aye, any man who ever had eyes in balls thought that.
He leaned a little closer.
She's a lusty little one. She'll trip a man who catches her eye. But she can't be talked or bought into bed. If she could, she'd be rich as a king of Vint.
He looked in her direction.
How much is a roll with that worth? I'd give...
He squinted in her direction, his lips moving as if going through some silent, complex arithmetic. After a moment, he shrugged.
More than I've got...
He looked back to me, shrugged again.
Still, it's no good wishing. Save yourself the trouble. If you want, I know a lady here who's no shame to look at. Might be willing to brighten up your evening.
He started to look around the room.
No.
I put my hand on his arm to stop him. I was just curious, that's all. I sounded insincere and I knew it. Thanks for filling me in.
Nothing to it.
He carefully got to his feet. Oh, I said, as if a thought had just occurred to me. Could you do me a favor? He nodded, and I gestured him closer. I'm worried Hespa might end up talking about our job for the mayor. If the bandits here were hunting them, things will get 10 times harder. A guilty look flashed across his face. I'm pretty sure she wouldn't mention it, but you know how women like to talk.
I understand. He said quickly as he stood up. I'll talk to her. Better to be careful.
The hawk-faced fiddler finished his jig, and everyone clapped and stomped and pounded empty mugs on their tables. I sighed and rubbed my face into my hands. When I looked up, I saw Martin at the table next to mine. He touched his fingers to his forehead and nodded a small salute. I gave a slight, seated bow. It was always nice to have an appreciative audience. Chapter 78. Another Road, Another Forest. I took a certain dark pleasure in seeing a rather hungover Daydan on the road before the sun was fully in the sky the next morning. The large man carried himself delicately, but, to give him due credit, he didn't offer a word of complaint, unless the occasional low moan can be counted as a word. Now that I was watching more closely, I spotted the marks of infatuation on Daydan. The way he said Hespa's name, the coarse jokes he made when talking to her. Every few minutes he would find an excuse to glance in her direction, always under some pretext, a stretch, an idle glance at the road, a gesture to the trees around us. Despite this, Daydan remained oblivious to the sporadic courtship Hespa was paying him in return. At times it was amusing to watch, like a well-orchestrated Modagan tragedy. At times, I wanted to strangle them both. Tempi traveled wordlessly among us like a mute, well-behaved puppy. He watched everything, the trees, the road, the clouds. If it weren't for the unquestionably intelligent look in his eyes, I'd have thought him a simpleton by this point. The few questions I put to him were still met with awkward fidgeting nods, shrugs, or shakes of the head. All the while my curiosity nagged at me. I knew the Lathani was just a piece of storybook nonsense, but part of me couldn't help but wonder. Was he really saving his words? Could he really use his quiet like armor? Move fast as a snake? The truth was, after catching glimpses of what Elksa, Dal, and Fella could do by calling on the names of fire and stone, the thought of someone storing up words to burn as fuel didn't seem nearly as foolish as it used to. The five of us got to know each other in dribs and drabs, growing familiar with each other's quirks. Daydan carefully groomed the ground where he lay his bedroll, not just removing twigs and stones, but stomping flat every tuft of grass or lump of dirt. Hespa whistled tunelessly when she thought no one was listening and picked her teeth methodically after every meal. Martin wouldn't eat meat that had the barest bit of pink to it or drink water that hadn't been boiled or mixed with wine. He told the rest of us at least twice a day that we were fools for not doing the same. But in terms of odd behavior, Tempi was the prize winner of the lot. He wouldn't look me in the eye, didn't smile, didn't frown, didn't speak. Since we left the Pennysworth, he had made only one comment of his own free will.
Rain would make this road another road, this forest another forest.
He said each word distinctly, as if he had been deliberating on the statement all day. For all I knew, he had. He washed himself obsessively. The rest of us would take advantage of a bathhouse when we stopped at an inn, but Tempi bathed every day. If there was a stream handy, he would bathe both at night and then again when he woke. Otherwise, he would wash himself using a cloth and some of his drinking water. And twice a day, without fail, he performed an elaborate ritual stretch, his hands making careful shapes and patterns in the air. It reminded me of the slow court dances they perform in Modag. It obviously kept him limber, but it was strange to watch. Hespa made jokes about how if the bandits asked us to dance, our sweet-smelling mercenary would be a wonderful help, but she said it quietly when Tempi was out of earshot. In terms of quirks, I suppose I was in no position to throw stones. I played my lute most evenings, when I wasn't too weary from walking. I dare say it didn't improve the others' opinion of me as a tactical leader or arcanist. As we neared our destination, I grew increasingly anxious. Martin was the only one of us truly suited to this work. Daydan and Hespa would be good in a fight, but they were troublesome to work with. Daydan was argumentative and stubborn. Hespa was lazy. She rarely helped prepare meals or clean up afterward unless she was asked, and even then her help was so grudging it was barely any help at all. And then there was Tempi, a hired killer who wouldn't look me in the eye or hold a conversation, a mercenary I firmly believed could look forward to a decent career in the Modagan Theater. 5 days after leaving Severin, we came to the area where the attacks had been made. A 20-mile stretch of twisting road that ran through the Eld. No towns, no inns, not even an abandoned farm. An utterly isolated stretch of the King's Highway in the middle of an endless ancient wood. The natural habitat of bears, mad hermits, and poachers. A highwayman's paradise. Martin went scouting while the rest of us set up camp. An hour later, he emerged from the trees, winded but in good spirits. He reassured us he hadn't found sign of anyone else nearby.
"I can't believe I'm defending tax collectors,"
Daydan muttered disgustedly. Hespa gave a throaty laugh. "You're defending civilization," I corrected, "and you're keeping the roads safe. Besides, Mayor Alvaron does important things with those taxes," I grinned. "Like pay us."
"That's what I'm fighting for," Martin said.
After dinner, I outlined the only strategy I'd been able to come up with in 5 long days of thinking. I drew a curving line on the ground with a stick. "Okay. Here's the road, about 20 miles of it."
"Miles?"
The soft voice was Tempe's. "Excuse me?" I asked. This was the first thing I had heard him say in a day and a half.
"Miles."
His accent was so thick around the unfamiliar word that it took me a second to understand he was saying miles.
"Miles,"
I said distinctly. I pointed in the direction of the road and held up one finger. "From here to the road is 1 mile. Today we walked 15 miles. He nodded once. I turned back to my drawing. "It's safe to assume the bandits are within 10 miles of the road." I drew a box around my crude sketch of the road. "That gives us 400 square miles of forest to search." There was a moment of silence as everyone absorbed that piece of information. Finally, Tempe spoke.
"That is large."
I nodded seriously. "It would take us months to search that much territory, but we shouldn't have to." I added a couple more lines to my drawing. "Every day, Martin will scout ahead for us." I looked up to him. "How much ground can you safely cover in a day?" He thought for a second, looking around at the trees surrounding us.
"This forest, with this much under scrub, about 1 square mile.
"How many if you're being careful?" He smiled.
"I'm always careful."
I nodded and drew a line parallel to the road. "Martin will scout a strip about 1/2 mile wide, about 1 mile back from the road. He'll keep an eye out for their camp or their sentries, so the rest of us don't stumble into them accidentally." Hespa shook her head.
"That's no good. They won't be that close to the road. If they're looking to stay hid, they'll be farther back, at least 2 or 3 miles.
Daydan nodded.
"I'd make sure I was at least 4 miles from the road before I hunkered down and made a habit of killing folk."
"I think so too," I agreed. "But they have to make their way to the road sooner or later. They have to post lookouts and travel back and forth for ambushes. They need to reprovision themselves. Since they've been here several months, odds are they've worn some sort of trail." I added a little detail to my dirt map with my stick. "After Martin is scouted, 2 of us will go in and make a careful search behind him. We'll cover a thin strip of forest, searching it for any sign of their trail. The other 2 will keep an eye on the camp. We can cover about 2 miles a day. We'll start on the north side of the road and search from west to east. If we don't find a trail, we'll cross to the south side of the road and work our way back from east to west." I finished drawing in the dirt and stood back. "We'll find their trail in a span of days, maybe 2, depending on our luck." I leaned back and drove my stick into the ground. Daydan stared bleakly at the rough map.
"We'll need more supplies."
I nodded. "We'll move camp every 5th day. 2 of us will walk back to Crossan to get supplies. The other 2 will move the camp. Martin will rest." Martin spoke up.
"We'll have to be careful with our fires from now on, too," he said. "The smell of smoke will give us away if we're upwind of them."
I nodded. "We'll need a fire pit every night, and we'll want to keep an eye out for rennel trees." I looked at Martin. "You know what a rennel looks like, don't you?" His expression was surprised. Hespa looked back and forth between us.
"What's Rennell?" she asked.
"It's a tree," Martin said. "Good for firewood. It burns clean and hot. No smoke to speak of, and hardly any stink of smoke either."
"Even when the wood is green," I said. "Same with the leaves. It's useful stuff. It doesn't grow everywhere, but I've seen some around."
"How does a city boy like you know something like that?" Daydan asked.
"Knowing things is what I do," I said seriously. "And what in the world makes you think I grew up in a city?" Daydan shrugged, looking away.
"That should be the only wood we burn from here on out," I said. "If it's in short supply, we'll save it for a cook fire. If we don't have any, we'll have to eat cold, so keep an eye out."
Everyone nodded, Tempe slightly later than the rest. "Lastly, we'd better have our story straight in case they stumble onto us while we're looking for them." I pointed to Martin. "What are you going to say if someone catches you while you're out scouting?" He looked surprised, but hardly hesitated in his response.
"I'm a poacher."
He pointed to his unstrung bow leaning against a tree.
"It won't be far from the truth."
"And you're from?"
There was a flicker of hesitation.
"Crossin', just a day west of here."
"And your name is?"
Maris,
he said awkwardly. Dayton laughed. I cracked a smile.
"Don't lie about your name. It's hard to do convincingly. If they catch you and let you go, fine. Just don't lead them back to our camp. If they want to take you back with them, make the best of it. Pretend you'd like to join up. Don't try to run."
Martin looked uneasy.
"I just stay with them?"
I nodded. "They'll expect you to run on the first night if they think you're stupid. If they think you're clever, they'll expect you to run on the second night. But by the third night, they should trust you a bit. Wait until midnight, then start some sort of disturbance. Light a couple of tents on fire or something. We'll be waiting for the confusion and take them apart from the outside."
I looked around at the other three.
"The plan is the same for any of you. Wait until the third night."
"How will you find their camp?" Martin asked, a thin layer of sweat on his forehead.
I didn't blame him. This was a dangerous game we were playing.
"If they catch me, I won't be there to help track you down."
"I won't be finding them," I said. "I'll be finding you. I can find any of you in the forest." I looked around the fire, expecting at least a grumble from Daydan, but none of them seemed to doubt my arcane abilities. Idly, I wondered how much they thought I was capable of. The truth was, I'd surreptitiously collected a hair from each of them in the last few days, so I could easily create a makeshift dousing pendulum for anyone in the group in less than a minute. Given vintage superstition, I doubted they'd be happy knowing the specific details.
"What should our stories be?"
Hespa tapped Daydan on the chest with the back of her hand, her knuckles making a hollow noise on his hard leather vest.
"Do you think you could convince them you were disgruntled caravan guards who had decided to turn bandit?"
Daydan snorted.
"Hell, I've thought about it once or twice."
At a look from Hespa, he snorted.
"Don't tell me you haven't done the same. Span after span of walking in the rain, eating beans, sleeping on the ground, all for penny a day?"
He shrugged.
"God's teeth, I'm surprised half of us don't take to the trees."
I smiled. "You'll do just fine."
"What about him?"
Hespa jerked her thumb at Tempe.
"Nobody is going to believe he's gone wild. Adam make 10 times what we do for a day's work."
20 times, Daydan grumbled.
I'd been thinking the same thing. "Tempe, what will you do if you are found by the bandits?" Tempe fidgeted a little, but didn't say anything. He looked at me briefly, then broke eye contact, glancing down and to the side. I couldn't tell if he was thinking or merely confused.
"If it weren't for his Adem Reds, he wouldn't look like anything special," Martin said. "Even the sword doesn't look like much."
"Doesn't look like 20 times as much as me, that's for sure,"
Daydan's voice was low, but not so low that everyone couldn't hear. I was worried about Tempe's outfit, too. I'd tried to draw the Adem into a conversation several times with the hope of discussing the problem with him, but it was like trying to have a chat with a cat. But the fact that he hadn't known the word miles made me realize something I should have thought of long before. Aturan wasn't his native language. Having recently struggled to make myself fluent in Siaru at the university, I could understand the impulse to keep quiet rather than speak and make a fool of myself.
He could try to play along, same as us, Hespa said dubiously.
It's hard to lie convincingly when you're not good with the language, I said. Tempe's pale eyes darted to each of us as we spoke, but he didn't offer any comment.
Folk underestimate a person who can't speak well, Hespa said. Maybe he could sort of just play dumb? Act confused, like he was lost.
Wouldn't have to play dumb, Daydan continued under his breath. Could just be dumb.
Tempe looked at Daydan, still expressionless, but with more intensity than before. He drew a slow, deliberate breath before speaking.
Quiet is not stupid, he said, his voice flat. You always talk. Check, 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 check.
He made a motion with one hand, like a mouth opening and closing.
Always. Like dog all night barking at tree. Try to be big. No, just noise. Just dog.
I shouldn't have laughed, but it caught me completely off guard, partly because I thought of Tempe as so quiet and passive, and partly because he was absolutely right. If Daydan were a dog, he would be a dog that barked endlessly at nothing, barking just to hear himself bark. Still, I shouldn't have laughed, but I did. Hespa laughed too and tried to hide it, which was worse. Daydan's face went dark with anger, and he got to his feet.
You come here and say that.
Still expressionless, Tempe stood and walked around the fire until he stood next to Daydan. Well, if I say he stood next to him, you will take the wrong impression. Most people stand 2 or 3 feet away when talking to you, but Tempe walked until he was less than a foot away from Daydan. To get any closer, he would have had to give him a hug or climb him. I could lie and say this happened too quickly for me to intervene, but that wouldn't be true. The simple truth was that I couldn't think of an easy way to break up the situation, but the more complicated truth was that I was pretty fed up with Daydan myself by this point. What's more, this was the most I'd ever heard Tempe speak. For the first time since I'd met him, he was behaving like a person, not just some mute ambulatory doll. And I was curious to see him fight. I'd heard a lot about the legendary Adem prowess, and I was hoping to see it thump some of the sullen mutter out of Daydan's thick head. Tempe walked up to Daydan, standing close enough to put his arms around him. Daydan stood a full head taller, broader across the shoulders, and thicker in the chest. Tempe looked up at him without a trace of anything you might expect to see on his face. No bravado. No mocking smile. Nothing.
Just dog, Tempe said softly with no particular inflection. Big noise dog.
He lifted up his hand and made a mouth of it again. Check, check, check. Daydan lifted a hand and shoved hard against Tempe's chest. I'd seen this sort of thing countless times in the taverns near the university. It was the sort of shove that sends a man staggering backward, off balance, and prone to stagger and trip. Except Tempe didn't stagger. He just stepped away. Then he reached out casually and cuffed Daydan along one side of his head, the way a parent might swat an unruly child in the market. It wasn't even hard enough to move Daydan's head, but we could all hear a soft paff sound, and Daydan's hair puffed out like a milkweed pod someone had blown against. Daydan stood still for a moment, as if he couldn't quite understand what had happened. Then, he frowned and brought both hands up to give Tempe a more violent shove. Tempe stepped away from this, too, then swatted Daydan on the other side of his head. Daydan scowled, grunted, and brought his hands up making fists. He was a big man, and his mercenary leathers creaked and strained at the shoulders as he lifted his arms. He waited a moment, obviously hoping Tempe would make the first move. Then he stomped forward, drew his arm back, and threw a punch, hard and heavy as a farmhand swinging an axe. Tempe saw it coming and stepped away a third time, but halfway through his clumsy swing, everything about Daydan changed. He raised himself up on the balls of his feet, and his ponderous haymaker punch evaporated. Suddenly, he no longer looked like a lumbering bull, and instead, he darted forward and snapped out three quick punches, fast as a bird's wing flapping. Tempe sidestepped one, slapped the other aside, but the third caught him high on the shoulder, spinning him partway around and knocking him backward. He took two quick steps out of Daydan's reach, regained his balance, and shook himself slightly. Then he laughed, high and delighted. The sound softened the expression on Daydan's face, and he grinned in return, though he didn't lower his hands or move off the balls of his feet. Despite this, Tempe stepped up, avoided another jab, and struck Daydan in the face with the flat of his hand. Not across the cheek, as if they were squabbling lovers on stage. Tempe's hand came down from above and struck Daydan across the front of his face, from his forehead down to his chin.
"Ah!" Daydan shouted. "Black damn!"
He staggered away, clutching at his nose.
"What's wrong with you? Did you just slap me?"
He peered out at Tempe from behind his hand.
"You fight like a woman!"
For a moment, Tempe looked as if he might object. Then he gave the first smile I had ever seen from him and gave a small nod and a shrug instead.
"Yes, I fight like a woman."
Daydan hesitated, then laughed and clapped Tempe roughly on the shoulder. I half expected Tempe to dart away from his touch, but instead the Adem returned the gesture, even to the point of gripping Daydan's shoulder and jostling him around playfully. The display struck me as odd coming from someone who had been so reserved over the last several days, but I decided not to look a gift horse in the mouth. Anything other than fidgety silence from the Adem was a blessing. Even better, I now had a measure of Tempe's fighting ability. Whether or not Daydan wanted to admit it, Tempe obviously had the better of him. I guess the Adem reputation was more than just empty air. Martin watched Tempe return to his seat.
"Those clothes are still a problem," the woodsman said, as if nothing much had happened.
He eyed Tempe's blood-red shirt and pants.
"Might as well run around waving a flag as wear that in the trees."
"I'll talk with him about it," I told the others. If Tempe was self-conscious about his Aeturin, I guessed our conversation would go more smoothly without an audience. "And I'll work out what he'll do if he runs into them. You three can go settle in and get dinner started." The three of them scattered off, looking to claim the prime places for their bedrolls. Tempe watched them go, then turned back to look at me. He glanced down at the ground and took a small, shuffling step away.
"Tempe?"
He cocked his head and looked at me.
"We need to talk about your clothing."
It happened again as soon as I started to talk. His attention slowly slid away from me, his eyes drifting down and to the side, as if he couldn't be bothered to actually listen, as if he were a sulky child. I don't need to tell you how infuriating it is to try and have a discussion with a person who won't look you in the eye. Still, I didn't have the luxury of taking offense or putting off this talk. I'd already delayed this conversation too long.
"Tempe." I fought the urge to snap my fingers in order to draw his attention back to me. "Your clothes are red," I said, trying to keep it as simple as possible. "Easy to see. Dangerous." He gave no response for a long moment. Then his pale eyes darted up to mine and he nodded, a simple bob of the head. I began to have a horrible suspicion that he might not actually understand what it was we were doing out here in the Eld.
"Tempe, you know what we are doing out here in the forest?" Tempe's eyes moved to my rough sketch in the dirt, then back up at me. He shrugged and made a vague gesture with both hands.
What is many, but not all?
At first, I thought he was asking some strange philosophical question. Then I realized he was asking for a word. I held up my hand and grabbed two of my fingers.
Some?
I grabbed three fingers.
Most?
Tempe watched my hands intently, nodding.
Most, he said, fidgeting. I know most. Talk is fast.
We are looking for men. His eyes slid away as soon as I started to speak, and I fought the urge to sigh. We are trying to find men.
Nod. Yes. Hunt men.
He stressed the word.
Hunt the Santa.
At least he knew why we were here. Red? I reached out and touched the red leather strap that held the fabric of his shirt tight to his body. It was surprisingly soft.
For hunting. Do you have other clothes? Not red?
Tempe looked down at his outfit, fidgeting. Then he nodded and went over to his pack and drew out a shirt of plain gray homespun. He held it up for me.
For hunting, but not fighting.
I wasn't sure what his distinction meant, but I was willing to let it go for now.
What will you do if Visanta find you in the forest? I asked. Talk or fight?
He seemed to think about it for a moment.
Not good at talk, he admitted.
Visanta,
fight.
I nodded. One bandit, fight. Two, talk. He shrugged.
Can fight, too.
Fight and win? He gave another nonchalant shrug and pointed to where Daydan was carefully picking twigs out of the sod.
Like him? Three or four.
He held out his hand, palm up, as if offering me something.
If three bandit, I fight. If four, I try best talk. I wait until three night. Then...
He made an odd, elaborate gesture with both hands.
Fire intense.
I relaxed. Glad he had followed our earlier discussion.
Yes. Good.
Thank you. The five of us had a quiet dinner of soup, bread, and a rather unimpressive gummy cheese we'd bought in Crossan. Daydan and Hespa bickered in a friendly way, and I speculated with Martin about what sort of weather we might expect over the next few days. Other than that, there wasn't much chatter. Two of us had already come to blows. We'd come 100 miles since Severin, and we were all aware of the grim work ahead of us.
Hold on, Martin said. What if they catch you?
He looked up at me.
We all have a plan if the bandits find us. We head back with them, and you'll track us down on the third day.
I nodded. And don't forget the distraction. Martin looked anxious.
But what if they catch you? I don't have any magic. I can't guarantee I'll be able to track them down by that third night. Probably, sure, but tracking isn't a certain thing.
I'm just a harmless musician, I reassured him. I got in some trouble with the Baronet Banbride's niece and thought it would be best if I legged it into the forest for a while. I grinned. They might rob me, but as I don't have much, they'll probably just let me go. I'm a persuasive fellow, and I don't look like much of a threat. Daydan muttered something under his breath I was glad I couldn't hear.
But what if?
Hespa pressed.
Martin's got a point. What if they take you back with them?
That was something I hadn't figured out yet. But rather than end the evening on a sour note, I smiled my most confident smile. If they take me back to their camp, I should be able to kill them off myself without much trouble. I shrugged with exaggerated nonchalance. I'll meet you back at camp after the job is done. I thumped the ground beside me, grinning. I had intended it as a joke. Sure, Martin at least would chuckle at my flippant response. But I'd underestimated how deep Vintic superstition tends to run, and my comment was met with an uncomfortable silence. There was little conversation after that. We drew lots for the watch, doused the fire, and one by one we drifted off to sleep. Chapter 79, Signs. After breakfast, Martin began teaching Tempe and me how to search for the bandit's trail. Anyone can spot a piece of torn shirt hanging from a branch or a footprint gouged into the dirt, but those things never happen in real life. They make for convenient plot devices in plays, but really, when have you ever torn your clothing so seriously that you've left a piece of it behind? Never. The people we were hunting were clever, so we couldn't count on them making any obvious mistakes. That meant Martin was the only one among us who had any idea what we were really looking for. "Any broken twig," he said. "They'll mostly be where things are thick and tangled, waist high or ankle high." He gestured as if kicking through thick scrub and pushing things aside with his hands. "Seeing the actual break is hard, so look at the leaves instead." He gestured to a nearby bush. "What do you see there?" Tempe pointed at a lower branch. He wore his plain gray homespun today, and without his mercenary reds, he looked even less imposing. I looked where Tempe was pointing and saw the branch had been snapped, but not badly enough to break off. "So someone has been through here?" I asked. Martin shrugged his bow higher up on his shoulder. "I was. I did this last night." He looked at us. "See how even the leaves that aren't hanging strange are starting to wilt?" I nodded. "That means someone has been by this way within a day or so. If it's been 2 or 3 days, the leaves will brown out and die. You see both close to each other." He looked at me.
"It means you have someone moving through the area more than once, days apart."
He nodded.
"Since I'm scouting and keeping an eye out for bandits, you'll be the ones with your noses to the ground. When you find something like this, call me."
"Call?" Tempe cupped his hands around his mouth and turned his head in different directions. He made a wide gesture to the surrounding trees and put his hand to his ear, pretending to listen. Martin frowned.
"You're right. You can't just go shouting for me."
He rubbed the back of his neck in frustration.
"Damn. We didn't think this all the way through."
I smiled at him. "I thought it through," I said, and brought out a rough wooden whistle I'd carved last night. It only had 2 notes, but that was all we needed. I put it to my mouth and blew ta-ta-dee, ta-ta-dee. Martin grinned.
"That's a Will's widow, isn't it? The pitch is dead on."
I nodded.
"That's what I do."
He cleared his throat.
"Unfortunately, Will's widow is also called the night jar."
He grimaced apologetically.
"Night jar, mind you. That'll catch at the ear of any experienced woodman like a fishhook if you go blowing it every time you want me to come take a look at something."
I looked down at the whistle. "Black hands," I swore. "I should have thought of that."
"It's a good idea," he said. "We just need one for a daytime bird. Maybe a gold piper."
He whistled 2 notes.
"That should be simple enough."
"I'll carve a different one tonight," I said, then reached down for a twig. I snapped it and handed half to Martin. "This will do if I need to signal you today." He looked at the stick oddly.
"How exactly will this help?"
"When we need your opinion on something we found, I'll do this." I concentrated, muttered a binding, and moved my half of the stick. Martin jumped 2 feet up and 5 feet back, dropping the stick. To his credit, he didn't shout.
"What in 10 hells was that?"
he hissed, wringing his hand. His reaction had startled me, and my own heart was racing.
Martin, I'm sorry. It's just a little sympathy. I saw a wrinkle in between his eyebrows and changed my tack. Just a small magic. It's like a bit of magic string I use to tie two things together. I imagined Elxadol swallowing his tongue at this description, but pressed ahead. I can tie these things together, so when I tug on mine, I moved to stand over where his half of the twig lay on the ground. I raised my half, and the half on the ground lifted into the air. My display had the desired effect. Moving together, the two twigs looked like the crudest, saddest string puppet in the world. Nothing to be frightened of. It's just like invisible string, except it won't get tangled or caught on anything.
How hard will it pull at me?
He asked warily.
I don't want it yanking me out of a tree when I'm scouting.
It's just me on the other end of the string, I said. I'll just jiggle it a bit, like the float on a fishing line.
Martin stopped wringing his hand and relaxed a little.
Startled me is all, he said.
That's my fault, I said. I should have warned you. I picked up the stick, handling it with a deliberate casualness, as if it were nothing more than an ordinary stick. Of course, it was nothing more than an ordinary stick, but Martin needed to be reassured as to that point. It's like Tekum said, nothing in the world is harder than convincing someone of an unfamiliar truth. Martin showed us how to see when leaves or needles had been disturbed, how to spot when stones had been walked across, how to tell if moss or lichen had been damaged by someone's passing. The old huntsman was a surprisingly good teacher. He didn't belabor his points, didn't talk down to us, and didn't mind questions. Even Tempe's trouble with the language didn't frustrate him. Even so, it took hours, a full half day. Then, when I thought we were finally finished, Martin turned us around and started leading us back toward the camp. "We've already been that way," I said. "If we're going to practice, let's practice in the right direction." Martin ignored me and kept walking.
"Tell me what you see."
20 paces later, Tempe pointed.
"Moss," he said.
"My foot. I walked."
Realization dawned, and I began to see all the marks Tempe and I had made. For the next 3 hours, Martin walked a step by humiliating step back through the trees, showing us everything we had done to betray our presence there. A scuff against the lichen on a tree trunk. A piece of freshly broken rock. The discoloration of overturned pine needles. Worst of all were a half dozen bright green leaves that lay shredded on the ground in a tiny semicircle. Martin raised an eyebrow and I blushed. I had plucked them from a nearby bush, idly shredding them while listening to Martin.
"Think twice and step carefully," Martin said. "And keep an eye on each other."
He looked back and forth between Tempe and me.
"We're playing a dangerous game here."
Then Martin showed us how to cover our tracks. It quickly became clear that a poorly concealed sign was often more obvious than one simply left alone. So over the next 2 hours, we learned how to hide our mistakes and spot mistakes that others had tried to hide. Only then, as afternoon was turning to evening, did Tempe and I begin searching this swath of forest bigger than most baronies. We walked close together, zigzagging back and forth, looking for any sign of the bandit's trail. I thought about the long days stretching out ahead of us. I'd thought searching the archives had been tedious. But looking for a broken twig in this much forest made hunting for the Graham seem like going to the baker for a bun. In the archives, I had the chance to make accidental discoveries. In the archives, I'd had my friends, conversation, jokes, affection. Looking sideways at Tempe, I realized I could count the words he had said today, 24, and the number of times he had met my eye, 3. How long would this take? 10 days? 20? Merciful Talu, could I spend a month out here without going mad? With thoughts like this, when I saw some bark chipped off a tree and a tuft of grass bent the wrong way, I was flooded with relief. Not wanting to get my hopes up, I motioned to Tempe. "Do you see anything here?" He nodded, fidgeting with the collar of his shirt, then pointed to the grass I'd spotted. Then he pointed to a scuffed bit of exposed root I hadn't noticed. Almost light-headed with excitement, I pulled out the oak twig and signaled Martin. I twitched it very gently, not wanting to send him into another panic. It was only 2 minutes before Martin came out of the trees, but in that time I had already formed 3 plans as to how to track and kill the bandits, composed 5 apologetic soliloquies to Denna, and decided that when I got back to Severin, I would donate money to the Talon Church as thanks for this tangible miracle. I expected Martin to be irritated that we'd called him back so soon, but his expression was purely matter-of-fact as he came to stand next to us. I pointed out the grass, the bark, and the root. "Tempe spotted the last," I said, giving credit where credit is due.
"Good," he said seriously. "Good job. There's also a bent branch over there."
He gestured a few paces off to the right. I turned to face the direction the trail seemed to indicate. "Odds are, they're going to be north of here," I said. "Farther from the road. Do you think it would be better to scout things out a bit now, or wait until tomorrow when we're fresh?" Martin squinted at me.
"Good Lord, boy. These aren't real trail signs. So obvious. All so close together."
He gave me a long look.
"I left them. I needed to make sure you weren't going to glaze over after a few minutes of looking."
My elation fell from someplace in my chest and landed around my feet, shattering like a glass jar tipped from a high shelf. My expression must have been pitiful, as Martin gave me an apologetic smile.
"I'm sorry. I should have told you. I'll be doing it off and on every day. It's the only chance we have to stay alert. This isn't my first time hunting through haystacks, you know."
The third time we called Martin back, he suggested we make a standing wager. Tempe and I would win a halfpenny for every sign we found, and he'd win a silver bit for every one we missed. I jumped at the offer. Not only would it help keep us on our toes, but 5-to-1 odds seemed rather generous. This made the rest of the day pass quickly. Tempe and I missed a few signs. A log shifted out of place, some scattered leaves, and a broken spider web. I thought this last one was a bit unfair, but even so, by the time we headed back to camp that evening, Tempe and I were 2 pennies ahead. Over supper, Martin told a story about a young widow's son who left home to make his fortune. A tinker sold him a pair of magic boots that helped him rescue a princess from a tower high in the mountains. Daydan nodded along while he ate, smiling as if he'd heard it before. Hespa laughed in places, gasped in others, the perfect audience. Tempe sat perfectly still with his hands folded in his lap, showing none of the nervous restlessness I'd come to expect from him. He stayed that way through the entire story, listening while his dinner grew cold. The story was a good one. There was a hungry giant and a riddle game, but the widow's son was clever, and in the end, he brought the princess back and married her. It was a familiar story, and listening to it reminded me of days long gone, back when I had a home, a family. Chapter 80. Tone. The next day, Martin left with Hespa and Daydan while Tempe and I remained behind to keep an eye on the camp. With nothing else to occupy my time, I started gathering extra firewood. Then, I searched for useful herbs in the undergrowth and brought water from the nearby spring. Then I busied myself by unpacking, sorting, and rearranging everything in my travel sack. Tempe disassembled his sword, meticulously cleaning and oiling all the pieces. He didn't look bored, but then again, he never looked like anything. By midday, I was nearly mad with boredom. I would have read, but I hadn't brought a book. I would have sewn pockets into my threadbare cloak, but I didn't have any spare cloth. I would have played my lute, but a trooper's lute is designed to carry music through a noisy taproom. Out here, the sound of it could carry for miles. I would have chatted with Tempe, but trying to have a conversation with him was like playing catch with a well. Still, it seemed to be my only option. I walked over to where Tempe sat. He had finished cleaning his sword and was making small adjustments to the leather grip.
Tempi?
Tempi lay aside his sword and came to his feet. He stood uncomfortably close.